This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
It's set. It's these the family of in Nebraska, these homesteaders at the turn of the century, and I think to try to take on that way of seeing and relating to the world, which is basically an extinct way of seeing and relating to the world. There is sort of a new grammar of thought that becomes available to you.
Well, there were definitely things that jumped out to me that felt like new areas of exploration. And one of them was a lot of your stories previously feel like they deal with adolescence. And yes, there are stories in this collection that deal with adolescence, but you also have stories that are dealing with what happens after you die with the story of the presidents reincarnated as horses. And then the story of the vampires in the Lemon Grove, which has to do with immortality and monogamy. So we're looking at some very different phases in life in this collection. And I was curious if that was linked to leaving behind childhood landscapes of your own as a writer.
Oh, that's such a smart, what a smart insight. You know, That's funny. I haven't really thought about it in those terms, but I'm sure that that's likely true, because my own adolescence and childhood are so connected to the swamps and malls of Florida. I mean, that's sort of where those dramas were staged. So I think that that's likely correct, right? That if I was going to write about, you know, a huge departure for me felt like the story The New Veterans, which it's a middle-aged masseuse in Wisconsin who's treating a soldier who suffers from PTSD. I think who knows how that story would have played out had I tried to set it in Florida. But to move away from the world of references that triggers childhood for me, I do think that then there's some freedom to try to imaginatively inhabit another stage of life, you know, one that I'm actually not at yet, right? Like, what would it really feel like to be, sort of heading towards the twilight of your life and to have this encounter with a young sergeant?
Well, there always seems to be a pairing of warmth and darkness in your stories to me. And in this collection, you definitely have that, the magical and the wondrous, but there's also several stories, and The New Veterans being one of them, where it feels like you fully own stories that are just dead on serious.
Yeah.
And it's a different tone than what you see in your first collection or Swamplandia, I think. And I was interested in that and the leaving of Florida also. And I was also just interested in what you found compelling about going full on into the horror genre, with Proving Up and with the story of Eric Mutis.
The Scarecrow Boy. Isn't that true? You know, that's so funny. Thank you for bringing that up, because a lot of the work, the editorial work we did, was consistency of tone. And I really had to be coaxed in some instances away. My impulse just in life and also in writing is often to, like, smash a pie on my face and, you know, tell a joke. In some cases, I think, in Swamplandia, in those first stories, I think there was some kind of funny, sad ratio that I was really trying to work out. And, you know, Saunders, who we mentioned, he's such an influence, and I think he does that better than anybody, to sort of use the humor to – it's not diffusing the tension at all. It's actually making more poignant whatever the really sad, unbearably sad thing is. But in some cases in this collection, like with The New Veterans, you know, it seems so, initially it seems so scary not to tell any jokes, right? Not to sort of ventilate some of the tension that was building. But there also, it also seemed like the only appropriate register to tell that story in, because, you know, I guess maybe there's like a handful of jokes that made the cut. I don't even remember now.
Well, it feels like there's a nice balance between the stories that have a real warm humor, like Vampires in the Lemon Grove, and these other stories which feel darker.
A first draft of that Silkworm Girl story. So this is a story about these Japanese, basically these female debt slaves who are incarcerated in a reeling mill, and they are turned into actual silkworms and sort of become a part of the factory machinery. And in a first draft, you know, it was a little more cartoony. It felt a little closer to the stuff in St. Lucie's, maybe. And I think at a certain point, it just became clear to me that for the end to have the kind of emotional punch I wanted it, I really was going to take the suffering very seriously. In a story that's already asking a lot of the reader to take, you know, to take seriously or to entertain the possibility that these women could really turn into silkworms. You know, I think something about the way that what the humor was doing was not in the service of the emotional heart of the story, actually.
That story you mentioned, Reeling for the Empire, where the women turn into silkworms, yeah. It feels like that is one way you could describe your work as all of it confronting the issue of metamorphosis. And even when you're in your less fantastical stories, just the setting of adolescence is one of metamorphosis, even if you yeah. strip away a magical it element is. To the story, right?
Yeah.
So what is it, as a writer, for you that brings you back to this idea of metamorphosis in your writing, both the magical way and also the way we change?
Yeah,
in
just
real life.
The way that selves change. I think that it's funny. I visited a high school today. I did like a writers in the schools visit, and I was struck by exactly that. You know, that age range where it's like some kids, they're 8 years old, they look like, you know, little freckly hot dogs. Some kids, they're four, you know, they look like construction workers already. It's just like hallucinatory, you know. They have these like Franken hands that are mashed onto their tiny bodies, and their feet are like gigantic rabbit feet. So it's like, I do think there's some kind of sci-fi period that is adolescence, where physically and emotionally you are undergoing these profound transformations that are totally seismic, day to day, everything is changing. I also think I'm really attracted to geographies where everything is unstable. You know, the swamp is like the true uncanny, right? It's sort of, it's neither land nor water. You can't get your bearings there. The tides are always revising it. I love also icy landscapes, I'm sure for the same reason, because there's just the threat that at any moment solid ground is going to melt and stream away. You know, that the sun is just going to cause a total collapse of this solid block of ice. So state changes, right? Like phase changes, I think I love. Part of that for sure comes from Florida, because the weather is so extreme there. So you have this kind of like cheery, happy hour denial of the fact that at any moment a wave or a hurricane is going to come and erase the territory that you once knew. So I think that when we were a kid, we you know, Hurricane Andrew did destroy our house. So I somehow think that experience left a big... had some kind of indelible mark on me, where it's like, no, nothing is so stable, right? Structures aren't stable. Personalities aren't stable.
And even in Reeling for the Empire, there isn't just the metamorphosis of the women as they get involved in this form of slave
right.
labor, but the period for Japan is also a time when the country is going through this big change.
Yeah, to set the story there was really exciting for me, because it was sort of what's happening to these women, where they're sort of enmeshed in modernity. It's happening to the entire island, you know, during this period. And I think what attracted me, or what first grabbed me about that story, beyond just the idea of these female revolutionaries in Japan, you know, and the way that feminist consciousness arises from this, like these terrible factory conditions, was just the shocking velocity of that change. So in a single generation, the whole landscape of your world changes. All these structures melt away. Suddenly you're introduced, you're jerked into modernity. And Florida, again, I mean, I think that must have had a resonance, because when I was growing up, the speed of development, the way that the skyline would change like roughly every 5 minutes in Florida, you know, you would like come home on your little bike and like another estuary of mangroves had been totally razed to the ground and there was like a condominium there. I think like that inertia was so frightening to me before I really had words for it either, you know? And the way that everybody seemed against it, all the adults would complain about it. They would talk about what we were doing to the environment, but no one could put the brakes on it. I mean, that was a real ecological horror story for everybody, you know, growing up in Miami in the 80s.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today with Karen Russell about our new short story collection, Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Karen, let's let our listeners listen to a little bit of the prose from the collection. Do you have something
yeah,
you want to read?
Yeah, I do. And thank you. This is something I never get to read. The Seagull Army Descends on Strong Beach, 1979. This is a story about this boy now who's growing up in a beach community that has been invaded by a mysterious flock of seagulls. Now everyone's going to have that song stuck in their head all day. The gulls landed in Atherton on July 11, 1979. Clouds of them in numbers unseen since the ornithologists began keeping records of such things. Scientists all over the country hypothesized about erratic weather patterns and redirected migratory routes. At first, Sullen now barely noticed them. Lost in his thoughts, he dribbled his basketball up the boardwalk, right past the hundreds of gulls on Strong Beach, gulls grouped so thickly that from a distance they looked like snowbanks. Their bodies capped the dunes. If Now had looked up, he would have seen a thunderhead of seagulls in the well of the sky, rolling seaward. Instead, he ducked under the dirty turquoise umbrella of the beach grub cart and spent his last dollar on a hamburger. While he struggled to open a packet of yellow mustard, one giant gull swooped in and snatched the patty from its bun with a surgical jerk. Now took two bites of bread and lettuce before he realized what had happened. The gull taunted him, wings akimbo on the beach grub umbrella, glugging down the burger. Now went on chewing the greasy bread, concluding that this was pretty much par for his recent course. All summer long, since his mother's termination, Now had begun to sense that his life had jumped the rails. And then, right at his nadir, he'd agreed to an avant haircut performed by Cousin Steve. Cousin Steve was participating in a correspondence course with a beauty school in Nevada, America. And to pass his Radical Metamorphosis 2 course, he decided to dye Now's head a vivid blue and then razor the front into tentacle-like bangs. "Radical," Now said dryly as Cousin Steve removed the foil. Cousin Steve then had to airmail a snapshot of Now's ravaged head to the United States desert, $17.49 in postage, so that he could get his beauty school diploma. In the photograph, Now looks like he is going stoically to his death in the grip of a small blue octopus.
This is one of my favorite stories in the collection. I've viewed The Seagull Army Descends on Strong Beach as a companion piece, weirdly, to Proving Up. And The Seagull Army, I feel like one of the themes around it is around wanting to live in the moment and be absorbed in the moment without self-consciousness. But yeah. The future keeps interfering, mm-hmm. in a sense, and keeps coming into the present. And Proving Up feels like the opposite, in a sense that the present is entirely defined by the future, the people who are waiting for the spring and they're waiting for the rain and they're waiting for their title. And in one respect, it felt like the future really looms over this whole collection when you think about the immortality of the vampires. And then you also think about the barn at the end of our term. How will we be remembered once right. we die? And I was wondering if the future loomed over it for you as a writer, having expectations as you go and you write a new collection of stories. It's got to feel very different than the first time you wrote a story collection, now that you have this audience and people who have certain desires from you as you write.
Yeah. Oh my God. I want to like roll a couch in here and we can do therapy sessions weekly. That's really, that's another amazing insight. I do think that this is a time-haunted collection. I think that there's a lot of dysfunction in the way that these characters are living in time. So that's really kind of fascinating to me. I don't know that I thought about them juxtaposed in that way, but definitely in this seagull story, there are these cosmic scavengers who are sort of like, you know, they have this indiscriminate appetite that's kind of ravaging his present. So much of those frontier tales, to me, it's just the promise has become a lie. I think Swamplandia, it's a similar story. You know, it's people who have not been able to adapt to a changed circumstance. They're either still living with a deluded attachment to some past dream, you know, or they're kind of being attacked by a future that will never arrive or hasn't arrived. But I think that's like kind of a universal, you know, I think that that's all, we're all in that bog together, right? I mean, it's really hard to live in noonlight. The Seagull Army story, what inspired it was this amazing essay by Andre Aciman called Mnemonic Arbitrage that Lord knows if he would even care to know that I don't think that he ever intended to spawn a weird story about a bunch of supernatural seagulls, but he talks about mnemonic arbitrage as being a financial metaphor for what kind of the brain wants to do all the time, which is to trade away the present to live, you know, either in the future or the past. So to experience, you know, like right now I would say, wow, I'm so nostalgic for that excellent interview that I had, you know, with David in Portland, just to reroute it, to get kind of like an extra hit of pleasure and to buffer yourself from the weirdness of being inside your body in the present moment. With the expectations, I don't know if that was, who knows, right? Maybe that was part of why I kept writing about these characters struggle to occupy their present. But I felt like with this collection, there was a lot of joy. It was written sort of over 5 years. So it wasn't, it's these stories, they've come from different periods too. I think that the toughest time, I pray to God, is done. And that was moving from St. Lucie's to Swamplandia. I think that was probably, if I'm time haunted, the hardest one, because I had been given this excellent opportunity and yet had no idea how to write a novel, didn't know if it would ever come to fruition, was working at a vet and kind of lint rolling puppy hair and cat dander off myself, and just it was not obvious at that point that you know, a novel would ever kind of come into being. So that was sort of tough.
That's interesting. I wanted to ask you a question about genre and its popularity right now, and, and particularly around a specific phenomenon that I've seen in the way we relate to monsters compared to the way they were originally related to, which connects to your title story. And in the title story, the vampires in the Lemon Grove, the vampires don't bite anymore. And that's actually seems to be a big theme in cultural consciousness now, when we see, for instance, say the TV show True Blood, where people can drink synthetic blood and assimilate into society, or Twilight, where they're going to high school. And then in Ben Percy's new novel with werewolves, it's a very similar situation where they're living among us and can take a drug to live with us. Mm-hmm. Whereas originally the vampire was very much other. He didn't live in town. He lived outside of town. Right. And invoked a different sort of terror. And I was curious if you had any thoughts about why we've shifted the place of the vampire or the werewolf within society, so it's so much closer now, wearing a sweater vest in the cul-de-sac next to us.
Right, with a comb over and a sweater vest and just taking its medicine. You know, that's so interesting. It's been interesting on this to feel kind of part of something that you never, you know, when I was writing that story, I think that was like such a lark initially. And it was before kind of this total cultural saturation of Stephanie Meyer and True Blood and these things. But I know that I was really drawn. There's a book I love called The Minotaur Takes a Cigarette Break, about this minotaur who's just working as like a line cook in some, you know, southern town, sitting on a bucket smoking, you know, while he works at like the you know, grub pit. I think something about that, to me, what felt resonant about it is just this idea that everybody has monstrous urges, and you have to find some way to live in the world and live in society. And the solutions available are, you know, some of you, I guess you can medicate yourself, you can, you know, that just a lot of temporary fixes seem to exist. But I wonder about that, right? That they're not living in exile anymore. They're sort of in our midst, but they've muzzled their desires. So something about that, right? Like the idea that there's some kind of, for sociability's sake, you know, whatever loneliness comes with denying some essential impulse so that you can be accepted by others, maybe.
That's very well put. You studied under Ben Marcus at Columbia University, and you've mentioned before in interviews a piece of advice that he gave you, and if you're going to have something weird, just have one thing be weird.
Yeah.
What does that mean for you?
I was writing Ben Marcus stories where everything was insane, right? It was a confetti plosion of whacked out stuff, and then it made the world feel frictionless. You know, there weren't any consequences, and the characters didn't really have anything to kind of come up against. You know, obstacles felt like holograms. So it wasn't great, right, for narrative or for reader's investment, you know. So just have one thing be weird. I think for me it's sort of like, if you're going to alter the universe of your fictional world, so let's say you're going to say, yeah, there are these vampires, but it turns out they don't strictly have to drink the blood. They're in recovery. Okay, well, that's it. So there's not also going to be an ant who's a cat. They're like three moons out of like Murakami style. You know, let's really treat that seriously. Take that premise seriously as a what if and see what a human personality, which is basically what these vampires are really, right? They're sort of like a monogamous couple on the skids. Let's see what would happen to them if that were the case. You know, so almost like a science experiment or something, right? Like, what if the daughters of werewolves were reeducated? Okay. Given that that's the constraint, let's not mess with things anymore. Let's not then introduce a fleet of ghosts and, you know.
It's probably what marks something that's literary and genre at the same time versus maybe something that's purely.
Maybe so. I mean, it's tough. I mean, I also think just it was helpful for me to really think about being a conscious architect of these places and saying, okay, it's true that you could take any freedom, but why are you doing it, you know, or to what end, in the service of what? So that it doesn't just become kind of like parade of things that I invented or, you know, like bad dream that I had after Thai food or something. Like it's really kind of, I've made a deliberate, you know, I've rearranged reality here. And I think it's because I myself have a question that I'd like to explore in this environment, you know. Like Swamplandia, so this girl falls in love with a ghost. What is that really, if you're taken hostage by an apparition or by a story, what does that feel like, you know, and what's the seduction there? So that, to really take those questions seriously anyways, if you're going to have one weird thing.
I'm curious about your thoughts about gender and sci-fi and fantasy. I at least on my own and from my perspective, it seems like sci-fi and fantasy traditionally is been the domain of boys, at least as readers, perhaps.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if you think that's actually true, but it feels like there's a trend going on in this generation in the popular culture. I think of, again, Twilight and Hunger
right.
Games and even Harry Potter, which feels like it's not specific in terms of its popularity among boys or girls. But then also with writers like you and Helen Oyeyemi and Kelly Link, that maybe this is a time when that's totally breaking down. I certainly think with Reeling for the Empire, which is both a fantastical story, but in a way also is a story about feminism and about the mechanization of mm-hmm. women's bodies, mm-hmm. literally, mm-hmm. that you're doing that work. And I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about being a woman doing this and the reception you received and
yeah.
if you feel like there are trends.
It's so funny. You know, I have to say, I feel a little, I always feel self-conscious answering questions about sci-fi, fantasy, and genre stuff because I feel kind of out of the game a little bit. You know, I mean, when I was 14, 15, I geeked out on all of that stuff. And in recent years, I just haven't, like Hunger Games, I don't know, I saw one of the movies, but I'm a little bit out of the mix. Kelly Link is someone who I love, and the books that Small Beer Press does, I love, and so many of them are women, right? I was just raving about After the Apocalypse by Maureen McHugh. I don't mm-hmm. know if you know her work.
Yeah, I read that.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And there's a lot of kind of gritty feminist dystopian stuff happening. I was reading some of the Ursula K. Le Guin. I was trying to teach, you know, the Omalaz story last semester. So, and of course, like Margaret Atwood. So I think those are, you know, people that I feel my work to be in conversation with because I was so influenced by their own writing. But I guess I don't have my finger on the pulse of what the young ladies are reading these days. I do feel a little bit out of it. I wonder kind of, what's interesting is to see people my age or a little bit older, like Juno Diaz or Shaban or Kelly Link, who I suspect we must have had very similar reading histories at some point. So that is neat to see them metabolizing. You can feel, right? Like you can feel Ursula in some of Kelly's work. You can feel, you know, Richard Adams or Frank Herbert, or definitely you can feel Tolkien throughout, you know, and in a very explicit way he's referenced in Juno's work. And so to see somebody taking on, you know, the history of the Dominican Republic through the lens of sci-fi, that's exciting.
You're working on a new novel now about the Dust Bowl. Can you tell us anything in our final minute about what themes you're exploring in the book?
Oh, man. I sound like I transitioned to Eeyore voice now when I talk about it. It's like, I'm like, well, I don't know. It's my moment of like the honeymoon is done, I think. Now we've sort of like entered the long marriage. But I'm excited. I think some of the same stuff that drew me to the Nebraska story, some of what we were just talking about, the people living dysfunctionally in time and hope turning into delusion, you know, it's a horror story for me about what people can endure.
Because is it fantastical? Also?
It's definitely it's fantastical. How could it not be? But it's sort of, yeah, it's a historical fantastical, I guess.
Well, it's great having you on Between the Covers, Karen.
I love being on Between the Covers, Behind the Covers. Thank you so much.
We've been talking today with Karen Russell, the author of Vampires in the Lemon Grove. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility's Particles on the Wall, an exhibit of the story of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation and the human environmental tolls of the nuclear age. The exhibit is being held at the EcoTrust Building, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. There is a reception on opening night, Friday, May 3rd, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. that is open to the public. The exhibit will show through June 14th. More information about this exhibit and opening night can be found online at the KBOO Community Radio Events page at kboo.fm.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
And welcome to the film show on KBOO. I'm S.W. Conser.
And I'm Jen Chavez. We are live in the studio talking about offbeat film festivals today. Director Eric Slade is here with us. His new film, Big Joy, will be featured in the upcoming Q-Doc, or the Portland Queer Documentary, Film Festival.
But first, Jen's guest is John Palahniuk, and John is part of an amazing film festival that could only happen in Portland, the Youth Silent Film Festival. Let's hear from Jen and John.
Thanks, Conch. I'm joined in the studio now by John Palahniuk, the president of the International Youth Silent Film Festival, a juried competition for filmmakers 20 and under, which sees their silent short films paired with live musical accompaniment. The Pacific Northwest Regional takes place this month at the Hollywood Theater, May 21st through 23rd. Thank you for joining us, JP.
Pleasure to be here.
So, as the founder of the Youth Silent Film Festival, can you give us a little insight into how the fest got started? Did it start locally?
It did. It is a local idea. I had attended a benefit where the theater organ was played, and there were four different organists at the benefit. The fourth musician that played was an 18-year-old boy by the name of Nathan Avakian. And first of all, you have to realize the theater organ looks like the cockpit of a 747. It is just the most complicated, amazing instrument that you can think of, and it was invented over 100 years ago. So Nathan gets up there, and he plays it just like a phenomenal musician would play any instrument. And I thought to myself, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if kids reinvented silent movies? And so that was the spark that lit the fire. And I asked Nathan and his teacher, who was at the benefit that evening, that I had an idea, and I was wondering if they would allow me to share it with them. And I formulated the idea. That benefit concert was at the end of November, and by January 8th, we had the website launched. The original scores that we commissioned Nathan to compose, again, composed by an 18-year-old, loaded and on the website, and we were off and running.
Is Nathan still involved with the festival at this point?
Nathan is. He's now in college, but he comes back and is one of our resident performers for the festival. We have, at this juncture, three resident performers that travel the world to perform on the theater organ to accompany live the three-minute films that are created for the competition.
So for this year, roughly how many submissions did you receive, and will those all go on to partake in the screening, or is there some sort of selection process?
There is a process. It is a competition. It's free to enter. The Pacific Northwest Regionals this year received over 100 entries. I just got back last month from flying out to Ohio to host the Midwest Regionals, and then I'll be flying down to Australia to host the Australian Regionals in October. So for the Pacific Northwest competition, we are just now in the process of jurying those films, and we screen the top 45 films, 15 original films each night over the three-night festival.
What is taken into account in the jurying of the films, not only at this stage, but also in the regional finals?
We jury them on four different criteria: cinematography, story, editing, and acting. So the jury process locally in each regional has individuals, leaders in the arts and civic-minded individuals and politicians that are invited to score the films. And the scoring is on a scale from 1 to 25, 100 being the perfect score. From that, we are able to determine the top 45 films for the screening at the festival. But also at that time, we were able to determine the top 10 films. Then the scores are wiped clean for the top 10 films, and those are sent to our celebrity jurors, which are big-name people in Hollywood, that then rescore the films to determine the first, second, and third place films.
And what are the filmmakers competing for?
The competition has several prizes. You can win a first prize of $1,000, or a second prize of $500, or a third place prize of $250. But wait, there's more. A lot of our celebrity jurors add experiential-based prizes.